You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday and Sunday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon, I'm Lou Sons, your host for Perspectives, and I am joined today with George Johnson. George Johnson is a journalist, and he has written various scientific articles with the New York Times and other journals. However, his latest book is called The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery. George, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
First of all, the way the book opens is kind of unusual because you take us back to Colorado and fossils and dinosaur.
Yes, right. I figured at some point while I was doing the research that no one would expect a book about the science of cancer to begin with a dinosaur. And that's what I ended up doing. I'd run across this little, it was just one of these little footnotes kind of floating around the internet where you would see like a timeline on the history of cancer, and then some of them would include a Jurassic Age dinosaur bone 150 million years ago that had signs of having had bone cancer. So I tracked that down and tracked down the paper and the scientists and things and just decided it would be a really interesting way to get into the book and then also just to maybe immediately get people to start questioning a lot of what they assume is true about cancer. Like before I'd started researching the book, I had assumed that cancer was much more of a modern phenomena, that perhaps it existed in the ancient past, but that it was far more prevalent today. And it's one of the things I really questioned in the book, and I thought a good way to get people thinking in a different time frame was to realize that we've had cancer at least since Jurassic times and probably almost surely ever since there were multicellular creatures, which basically includes all animals.
That it's interesting that you talk about the history of cancer because there are a lot of myths about what causes cancer. You can't eat this, you can't smoke that, you can't drink that.
Right.
And so we're wondering, what did dinosaurs eat that caused the cancer?
Yeah, I mean, this is the interesting thing. People have come to, as soon as they think cancer, they think carcinogen, and a carcinogen being something that causes cancer, whether
right.
it's a chemical in the water or radiation or an additive in food. And, you don't have to have a carcinogen in that sense to really have cancer. I mean, cancer is something that happens internally in the body. It really is an unfortunate consequence of evolution. So, basically, life started out as single-celled little creatures like bacteria. And at some point, way in the past, they learned to band together into groups, like mutual support groups, and these really evolved into the multicellular creatures, that includes us and the dinosaurs and everything in between. And but in doing that, you still have all these cells in the body, like there's something like 10 trillion cells in a human body. And these have to work very closely with their neighbors, exchanging signals and coordinating their activities, just as they might do if they were individuals in some kind of colony. And every once in a while, you get a cell that breaks out of the pack, and through mutations of various sorts, it develops this ability to grow faster than the others, to suppress the growth of the others, and it just starts really evolving on its own in the body. Now, some of those mutations happen because of carcinogens and chemicals in the atmosphere, but many of them, and probably most, are really just random errors because every time one of these cells divides to give birth to two daughter cells, it must copy its entire genome and then send the copy, a perfect copy, one to each of these cells. Well, the copies are never perfect. There's always going to be little errors and mistakes, and some of these are caught and corrected, some of these are not, and over time, in every line of cells in your body, these trillions of cells, you develop just the right combination of mutations so that the cell becomes cancerous, and then it's really, it's almost like this separate little alien creature growing on its own inside your body.
Hippocrates called it a crab. So as you mentioned, a creature reminds us of the movie Alien, where, you know, this monster pops out of the guy's chest. So did Hippocrates call it a crab because it latches on?
Well, yeah, there's different thoughts about that, and of course cancer is, you know, means crab, so the word really caught on, and Hippocrates, some people think he was talking about the way, you know, it kind of extends its tentacles like a tumor, you know, extending into different tissue around where it started. But then other people have pointed out, including Siddhartha Mukherjee, who wrote The Emperor of All Maladies, that cancer actually doesn't really look that much like a crab. And so there are other theories about that, and I get into some of those in the book.
Now, what about immortal life of Henrietta Lacks? Are some of those cells helping in cancer research?
Oh, yes, the HeLa cells. Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I mentioned before how a cell will develop all of these mutations that allow it to basically defeat all the safety mechanisms built into the cell by evolution. And when it does that, it starts growing on its own inside the body. And one thing a cancer cell does is it achieves, you know, what they call immortality. So cells normally have this built-in counting mechanism. So once a cell divides approximately 30 times, it basically, you know, it's registered as being too old, and then it kills itself. It destroys itself through what's called apoptosis, or programmed suicide. So a cell that evolves in a way that it can defeat this internal counting mechanism and this internal self-destruct mechanism essentially just keeps dividing and dividing without control. And that's really when a cell becomes immortal. And the HeLa cells are an example of one that they were basically immortal cell line that they were able to really tame and keep alive in a dish. And, you know, since then, it's, of course, just, you know, spread all over the world as a sample that's used in not just cancer research, but all kinds of medical research.
George, can you briefly give us an example? I mean, just, describe what that book is about by Rebecca Skutz.
Because it's about this woman, Henrietta Lacks. And it had been known for many, many years or decades, really, that there were these things called HeLa cells, H-E-L-A, that are used in the laboratory. And people knew they were named from the patient they had originally come from, the Henrietta Lacks. So they were Henrietta Lacks cells. And a little bit was known about her, that she was a black woman and that she was treated in Baltimore, I believe, at Johns Hopkins.
Yes.
And that she... very little else than that. She was a patient who was there because she was indigent, and they ended up keeping some of the cell cultures because she had cancer. And it just happened that they noticed that these cells, that they happened to keep, you know, they kept cells from a lot of people, and these had to really develop this powerful cellular immortality. And even though this is like a common phenomenon that happens in cancer, these cells were particularly robust, and they ended up being adopted and used for medical research. So the that's what Rebecca Skloot's book is about. And what she did, what was so amazing, is, you know, what no one else had done, was to track down the family and not just get a few little details about who Henrietta Lacks was, but to really get them to trust her and give her the story. So it was just this, you know, very impressive project of journalism that took... Oh, I mean, she was working on that for years and years and years.
One of the questions that some people always ask, there are a lot of myths about, well, you know, it's the area you live in. Perhaps the dinosaurs were exposed by this. And the government has a program called Surveillance Epidemiology and End Results Program, SEER. And it tracks state cancer incidence and mortality rates. And so... it's interesting what you put here, the fact that Kansas and Nebraska don't participate, but however, Hawaiians tend to develop liver cancer twice as much as people who live in Utah.
Yeah, that's one example. There are several little discrepancies like that, and then epidemiologists try to figure out what the imbalance is. I mean, obviously it's something about what people are doing or the genetics of the people in one place or the other, but they found in most cases that genetics, you know, like the genes that you inherit from your parents, have less to do with it than your behavior. In the sense, do you drink a lot, for example? Like alcoholism is related to liver cancer. And also the hepatitis virus is related to liver cancer. So if there's a place where people are more apt to get hepatitis, that would be one place where you would expect to see more liver cancer. Now, I don't know what the proposed mechanism is that explains that particular discrepancy, but there are a lot of interesting things like that. For example, there are what they call the migrant studies, where they show that Japanese, for example, who move to the United States, and in Japan, stomach cancer is quite a bit more prevalent than it is in the United States or most developed countries, but colon cancer and breast cancer less so, although breast cancer has been rising in Japan as well. But these studies that began in the 30s really tracked people who had emigrated from Japan, for example, to the United States, and they found after a generation that the same people here tended to get the cancers that were more common in the United States, like colon cancer and breast cancer, and not as much stomach cancer by far. So, you know, the question is, what is it about being in the United States that gives you these cancers and being in Japan gives you these other cancers? And again, there's various theories and ideas on this. And one is that a steady diet of salted fish raises your risk factor for stomach cancer. And another one is that it has something to do with the different ecosystems of bacteria, the so-called microbiome that might be living in the Japanese stomach in Japan than would be living in American stomachs after they had adapted to the American diet. And there are also things like one of the risk factors for breast cancer, for example, is being obese. Alcohol, maybe to a lesser extent. Also, not having children or having children later in life increases your risk. So if any of those behaviors became more true of Japanese people once, you know, they were in the United States for a while and their children, then that would tend to affect that cancer.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Japanese because there's an example about Mr. Yamaguchi, who survived both bomb attacks in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and he ended up living until he was 81, but died of stomach cancer.
Yeah, right. It was interesting, too, because, and again, you don't know, was it, you know, I mean, stomach cancer is very prevalent in Japan, so it might have just been the salty fish diet. But what's most remarkable, he was right near the blast at Hiroshima because he was in Hiroshima on a business trip. And then he got, you know, out of there, you know, escaped as soon as he could. I think his eardrums had been punctured. That's how close he was to the explosion. And then he gets on the train and goes back home, you know, to Nagasaki. And there actually have been several Japanese people in history who have found that they have found who, you know, had the bad luck to experience both of these horrible nuclear blasts, but that he ended up living to a very old age. But it's just so many of the things we assume are immediate death sentences. Like you assume that much radiation always gives you cancer, and yet it just, you know, it raises your risk certainly, but you know, it's not necessarily, you know, it's not never really strict causal thing. And that's another one of the big surprises in the book, was finding out so many things that I'd always assumed, like that eating a steady diet of fruits and vegetables is a significant factor in protecting you from getting cancer. Well, the latest epidemiology shows that just isn't true, or that that red meat really raises your chance of getting colon cancer. And it depends on how you look at it. For a middle-aged man like myself, a heavy diet of red meat has been shown in some good studies to triple your chances of getting colon cancer sometime in your life. But it triples it from 1.5% lifetime chance to 4.5%. So it's still, you know, very, very unlikely. And the studies were assuming someone ate a quarter pound of red meat every single day of his life.
One of the things that is speaking about men, prostate cancer is one of the things that affects men. And some people have said that it's not necessary that people who die died of the prostate cancer, because
exactly.
Most people who die when they're of that age already have develop some kind of cancer in the prostate, but that's not what killed them.
Yeah, right. Like they'll do autopsies of 70-year-old men or men in their 70s, and there have been studies like this where they did a number of these, and they would find that something like 75% of them had slow-growing, you know, sometimes they call them smoldering prostate cancers, and they died of something else entirely different and didn't even know they had prostate cancer. So you have some cancers like that that just slowly develop, and they're probably better left alone. But then again, there's not any really good way to tell if that's going to be one of the prostate cancers that doesn't do that. It just starts developing very quickly and spreads to your bones, and you know, and then it's often, you know, all over after that. So there's just so much randomness in you know, who gets cancer, and so often, in more cases by far than not, someone gets cancer, and you really don't know what causes were involved. It's really quite amazing. It's just so much of it. A phrase that I came up with when I was writing the book is that the most powerful carcinogen is entropy. And entropy being the natural state of the universe to become more random and more disorderly over time. So cells are randomly, you know, they're going to become, so a cell starts out as being, you know, every time a cell is born in your body, you know, from the division into two, from the mother cell, it's, you know, very high degree of order. And then as it divides again and again and passes its genes on to its progeny, there's slowly these mistakes that build up, and the order slowly breaks down. And this is basically what gives you cancer. So you could eliminate every carcinogen, you know, artificial carcinogen, chemicals and artificially produced radiation in the world, and you would still have this background core rate of cancer. So it's, you know, it's just not like other diseases where it's always something from outside that's coming in and giving you cancer. It's something, there's one scientist who used the word cancering, that your body is always cancering and producing little cancers here and there throughout your system. Most of them don't amount to anything. They're caught and eliminated by the immune system. But every once in a while, one will become extremely aggressive and just evolve into this beast that can just rapidly expand and start sending out colonies to start cancers in other parts of your body.
George, we are a nation who loves our red meat. Diet Cokes are now, they're talking about that if you drink Diet Cokes, they're very bad for you because the artificial sweetener can cause cancer. And yet the other caffeine that we love, coffee, if that's supposed to help lower oral and colon cancer.
Oh, it just depends on who's picking and choosing the studies. And the main thing to remember, really the thing that struck me, is all of those things are such tiny little effects. It's really kind of ridiculous to worry about them if you're going out into the sun all the time without sunscreen, for example, or certainly if you're smoking cigarettes. And these are some of the few things that you can say significantly raise your risk of getting cancer. But as for any particular food, whether, you know, it's dangerous or good for you in terms of cancer, it's all based on these tiny little effects and you know, mostly very questionable epidemiological studies. And it's very controversial for anything in particular. So, I mean, you can read that there's something like, you know, there's several hundred different chemicals in a cup of coffee that are labeled as carcinogenic, and yet, you know, a lot of us drink at least a couple of cups of coffee every day. Most of us are not going to get stomach cancer, and someone who drinks no coffee at all, you know, might very well get it. It's just not as simple as finding these you know, these certain things you can do and can't do. And, we like to think we have control. You know, this poor person got cancer because he or she did this or that, so I'm not going to do that. Or if someone we know or we ourselves get cancer, then suddenly we're thinking, oh, my God, you know, what did I do wrong? If only I hadn't done this and if only I hadn't done that. When, you know, in fact, you know, that's not what you should be worrying about. There's just so much of this is just random. Cells break down. Some people are more prone than other people, but yeah.
We're speaking with George Johnson, a medical journalist, and he's the author of the book, The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery. George, your book, in a way, tells two stories. The scientific part about, you know, what cancer is, cells and all that stuff, but then you also get very personal.
Well, yes, and I became interested in the subject. This is the ninth book that I've written, eight of which are about science. And mostly I'd written about, you know, the physical sciences, physics, astronomy, but all, you know, all books for a general audience, someone like myself who's not a scientist but finds it fascinating. And with this book, I really became interested in cancer when it was almost 10 years ago, and my wife, at the time, Nancy, was just suddenly, you know, diagnosed out of the blue with a stage 4, they call it metastatic cancer. You know, and stage 4 is the worst of the four stages, and a metastatic cancer is one that, in this case, by the time they caught it, it had already spread to the lymph system of her body, and then, you know, that's just the one stop on the way to other places. And, you know, at the time she was 43, you know, very, very healthy as far as, you know, eating all the right things, fruits and vegetables and all of that. And you know, a healthy, reasonably young woman. And then she has this stage 4 cancer. So I started reading more and more about the science then. Of course, we both were, and just trying to, you know, find reasons for hope. And I just knew at some point in those first couple of years, I mean, she had to have surgery and then chemo and then radiation. And I knew somewhere along the line I was going to end up writing a book about the science of cancer and somehow use her story as kind of a way to kind of link it all together, kind of a narrative backbone is how I think of it. And the way that it all came out was about a decade later. It'll actually be, next month will be 10 years since her diagnosis, and she's alive and well and healthy, and we're not married anymore, but she did, you know, by every appearance, beat this this terrible stage 4 cancer. And you mentioned there were two stories. The other story was my brother Joe, who was a few years younger than I am, and just about the time I was nearly finished with the book, you know, I got a call from Joe, and it turned out that he had been diagnosed with a cancer of the head and mouth, it was called. It was something that started as a pain in his jaw, and then it turned out to be something called squamous cell carcinoma. And it's a cancer it's a very aggressive one, but it's usually beatable. It's got a really high survival rate, unlike the one that my wife had. And yet within, before the year was out, within 9 months, he had died from it. And it's just a terribly, terribly sad thing. And I, you know, just looked at my wife's story and my brother's story, and you know, tried to what I've been trying to do in the book, or what I tried to do in the book, is just to make sense of them. I mean, how do you think about this? You know, how much is in our control? How much is randomness? How much do we know about the science? How much do we not know? And then just using those two stories as kind of bookends to bring it all together.
And it's interesting how, as you mentioned, it must have been very difficult for you to write that part. But you see people who are struck with cancer, and some of them survive, like your wife, and then others don't. And you're wondering why. Why did they? And you go to MD Anderson, and you see these people sitting there, and some of them just look awful. Some of them are very happy, but you're wondering what must the family be going through? Because a lot of times people try and be nice, they try and help you out, but they end up saying, as one professor here said, stupid things.
Yeah,
because they don't know what else to say to tell you.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, what do you say to someone who's in, you know, in late stage metastatic cancer of some sort with a very, very low survival rate, and it would be, you know, just an astonishing thing, a miracle if they survived it, and I mean, you know, you tell them, oh, it'll be okay. I know you can get through this. You're really strong, I've heard people say who have been in that position, the people with the cancer, that it makes it worse because it's just like, yeah, you know, great. I mean, you know, they appreciate the fact that people are uncomfortable and trying to figure out something cheery and encouraging to say, but, you know, they know that they know that it's just not true. And
well, it's a very mysterious disease, as you mentioned, and thank God it's going to be a year, November 16th, that my wife is a breast cancer survivor.
Oh!
And
I'm so glad to hear that.
Thank you. And it's just hard to deal with, as you mentioned.
Oh, then you know, yeah.
Yes. Now tell me about, do you have a webpage that people can go and find out more about your books or
yes,
your book?
Yes, I do. It's, I mean, if you Google my name, George Johnson, I come out pretty much in the top of the listings, and even though I have a pretty common common name. And also, I do have a website address I can give you, and it's Talaya, T-A-L-A-Y-A, .net.
That's T-A-L-A-Y-A.
T-A-L-A-Y-A,
.net. .net.
It's interesting. Talaya is the name of a peak near Santa Fe, where I live, that I can see out my window. And right next to it, there's Atalaya Mountain, and Atalaya, of course, means watchtower in Spanish, because the, you know, the mountain was used at a lookout. And sometimes how this smaller peak to the north of it, the name was corrupted to just Talaya. I found that interesting, so I decided to use that for the name of my website.
Well, George, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for sharing your personal story and also telling us about your book. The name of the book is The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery, and the author is George Johnson. Thank you for being with us, George.
Thank you, Luis, and best of luck to you and your wife.
Thank you. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTUP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Ingrid Flores, and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.